This morning, in the instructions, remember we introduced that feeling tone, vedana, of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Tonight I want to talk more in depth about the power of that foundation of mindfulness. And the title that I like to give for this talk is Transforming Suffering into Happiness. Pretty good formula. Are you ready? In Buddhist psychology, there are three roots of suffering. Three, what are sometimes called the three poisons. Greed, or grasping, attachment, wanting, desire, all named for the same thing, this wanting, possess. Ooh, it's strong. The song is strong tonight. Aversion is the second one. Not wanting what's here. Can we handle it? Or
it has been every evening.
It's just it's pretty hot with the windows closed. As I was saying, aversion, pushing away, not liking, anger. We talked about this when I gave the talk on the five hindrances. That moving away from experience, and delusion, or ignorance, which is not knowing what's happening, and more fundamentally, taking ownership of our experience and identifying with this sense of self. Those are the three roots of suffering: greed, hatred, delusion, or attachment, aversion, ignorance, same thing. The three roots of happiness are the opposite. Non-greed, which, more positively put, in Buddhist psychology or in Buddhist teachings, there's a lot of not this, not this, not this. They don't sometimes say it is this, it's just it's not this, and what is left you can figure out. But non-greed, which in its more positive aspects include both letting go and generosity. Non-hatred or non-aversion, which in its more positive aspect is kindness, loving kindness, and open-heartedness. And non-delusion, which more positively put is wisdom, clear seeing, non-identification, not taking it personally, and seeing clearly what's here. Or simply put, generosity, letting go, loving kindness, and wisdom. So there's suffering over here, there's happiness over here, and the key to changing one to the other is found in this feeling tone, this vedana, as we spoke of this morning, that pleasantness, unpleasantness, or neutrality of experience. Because usually, when things are pleasant, we want to possess them. When they're unpleasant, we want to push them away. When they're neutral, they don't hold our attention, and we kind of space out and get lost and get confused. So when we are present for the pleasant, instead of grasping, we can enjoy it fully. And I'll talk as the retreat goes on about the skillfulness of appreciating a pleasant moment and appreciating a wholesome state. So there's the pleasant, but there's not grasping. There's just being with it without that moving to possess. When it is an unpleasant moment, instead of pushing away, as I know that so many, probably all of you, have experienced, at times, just a little bit, letting it be okay, letting it be here, finding the courage to feel the difficult feelings, finding the wisdom to be with an unpleasant sensation for a little while without fighting and struggling. Non-aversion, or opening to this moment, even when it's unpleasant. And when things are neutral, to still be here and notice what's here. When it's even something as neutral as the breath, oh, I can be with this. Or to not get lost in identifying with our experience. So those are the three sources of well-being, and it's right there in that noticing the feeling tone for what it is without getting into the reaction. So one way to think of mindfulness is that every moment that you're mindful, you are cultivating non-greed, non-hatred or non-aversion, and non-delusion. Every single moment of mindfulness, you are planting seeds of real happiness. Every moment that you're not, you're likely to be caught in a reaction. So this is one reason why moments of mindfulness are so profound and freeing, and it's been really so moving to be with you in the groups and just hear your own wisdom coming through. That's the best for me. Each time at the beginning of a retreat, there's a couple of days where I'm thinking, I wonder if this time it's not going to work. Or those moments come to my mind. But it always works. I'm not guaranteeing you a wonderful retreat, but it's so beautiful to just see the wisdom just shine through, and you discover for yourself, just in the willingness to be here with your experience, there's something so profound and magical and mysterious about mindfulness opening the heart and giving us courage and helping us see so clearly how all of this stuff is just coming through us, and you don't have to blame yourself or take credit. Isn't it amazing? I've been doing this for so many years, and it never ceases to amaze me. Wow, this stuff really works. So I wanted to talk tonight specifically about these three pairs, greed, hatred, and delusion, and non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, both as it works in the practice, but also practically speaking in our life as well. So, first, this quality of greed or non-greed. I spoke already in the talk on the hindrances about desire and how we get entranced. You know, and I told the story of my son and the strawberry, how we miss out on the very pleasant experience when we're caught in grasping. Mm-hmm. This is here. This is from, thank goodness for these things. This is from a wise Tibetan teacher named Gendun Rinpoche. He says, happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already here in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do. Let the game happen on its own. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, space is here, open and inviting and comfortable. So make use of it. Don't search any further. Don't go into the inextricable jungle, the thicket in the jungle, looking for an elephant who is quietly at home. Nothing to do, nothing to force, and everything happens by itself. This is a great Tibetan teaching out of the Dzogchen practice. And it's a wonderful, it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, they tell you this after the preliminary practices, which include 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 mantra recitations, and 100,000 visualizations. Then they say, just relax. I'm kind of oversimplifying things, but it's both. It takes some work, but the real power of the practice, as it was so beautifully put today in one of the groups, is, oh, I don't have to struggle. I can just really relax and be here for this moment. Mm-hmm. But we find ourselves caught and struggling. And I don't think it's been mentioned here. Did I mention the monkey trap here? No. You know that story. as an example, just a private joke. Yeah. as an example, just to show you the predicament that we're in, the dilemma that we're in, there's a monkey trap that's used in Asia to catch monkeys because they tear up the crops and they get in the way in the field and they're a nuisance. So they take a coconut, cut off one end of the coconut, tie it to a stake, and inside the coconut they put some sweets, lots of sweets. The monkey comes along, smells the sweets, slips its hand in the coconut because it wants the sweets, grabs the sweets, except the way the trap is devised, the hole is big enough for the monkey to slip its hand in, but when it grabs a handful of sweets, it's stuck and can't get out. Knows that it's in trouble, can hear the humans coming, starts to panic. All it has to do is let go of those sweets, slip its hand out, and it's free. You get it, huh? It's a very rare monkey that figures that out. And that's pretty much the predicament that we're in. We think, oh, this is going to feel so good, or if I can only make this happen, I'm going to be happy. And we trap ourselves. And if we can somehow let go and trust and let life happen, we're free. Isn't that so amazing? And we can get caught in so many things, wanting so many things. Even when the moment is okay, we can then want just a little better moment. And here's a there's a comic strip. I don't know if it's in here in Finland. There's a very popular comic strip in the States, Calvin and Hobbes. Is Calvin and Hobbes here too? Okay. So this comic, this one strip, first frame, Calvin says, "Here I am, happy and content." Second frame, "But not euphoric." Euphoric means really happy. So, happy and content, but not euphoric. Third frame, "So now I'm no longer happy and content. I'm unhappy and discontent. My day is ruined." Last frame, "I should have quit thinking while I was ahead." Can you relate? Yeah, life is pretty good right now, but it would be so much better if you can fill in the blank. So it's really powerful how this wanting mind works. But the opposite is really where the freedom is, because no matter how good you get it, it's not going to last anyway. But that letting go, the freedom of letting go. There's a famous teaching from Ajahn Chah, that teacher of Ajahn Sumedho and Jack Kornfield's teacher. He says, if you let go a little, you'll have a little freedom. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of freedom. If you let go completely, you'll have complete freedom, and your troubles with the world will come to an end. And it's been lovely to see in your own practice, a number of people have talked about the moment where they've seen where they can let go and just let it be, and the freedom and the peace that comes from that. It takes some practice to get that more and more. But the more you practice it, and the more you practice it here, the more you see for yourself. It's not just an idea that you read about in a Buddhist book. This is where real happiness lies. This is the third noble truth. The first noble truth, there's suffering. Second noble truth, the cause of suffering is this attachment, is this wanting. The third noble truth, there is an end to suffering. And that is in letting go and opening to things just as they are. The fourth noble truth is there is a path that shows you the way to do this, the Eightfold Path. So I want to talk a little bit about the positive element of this grasping or wanting or greed, non-greed or letting go or generosity. Let's see. Letting go or renunciation. It's a word that's sometimes used in Buddhist teachings, renunciation. The Buddha talked about the joy of renunciation. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun, does it? But he said, lighten the load. And another word for renunciation is simplicity. We crave simplicity. Don't you? In America, there's a magazine called Real Simple. You don't have Real Simple here, do you? Real Simple, it's this magazine, 250 pages of different things that are going to make your life simpler. This will make your life simpler. Get this, this will make your life simpler. It's a very popular magazine because we love simplicity so much that we're willing to acquire so many things to get our life more simple. We love simplicity. You know that feeling when you finally clean out the closet and get rid of stuff that you haven't used in 5 years? Rarely do you say, afterwards, I shouldn't have given away that sweater. You know, it's gone, right? And the space feels so much better than the clutter. And in the same way with our minds, when we can let go of all of the stuff or all of the things that trouble us, not that we don't pay attention to them, but fundamentally letting go of believing all of these stories that come through. What a freedom that is, isn't it? When you can just finally see, that's a story. One of my main instructions for myself when I get really caught, I say to myself, what story am I believing right now? Sometimes, what thought am I believing right now? And after looking at my mind for so long, and this is, you don't have to wait for decades, you might get this very, very early on, you see how empty those thoughts are. And when you say, what thought am I believing right now? You see, it's just mind created. I don't need to hold on to that. I can see how empty it is. It takes practice because the habits are strong, but little by little it's possible. So I'll just talk now about the positive element of letting go, which is generosity. Because generosity is both the expression of letting go and the feeling of connection that we can have with each other. It's so beautiful. It was, we were talking about it in one of the groups today, just how good it feels, and I'll talk more about it, I think, tomorrow night in another talk, how good it feels to express your caring. And there's nothing in it for you, when it's genuine generosity, other than it just feels good to share. You know? Have you ever had something really good and we want to share it, right? Say you're having a really fantastic ice cream cone. Jamocha almond fudge. You know. There is, and you're with a friend and they're not having some ice cream. You ever have that feeling like, you gotta try this. It's so good. Not too big a bite. You gotta try it. Why? Because we want to share. We love to share with others. And the generosity that we share, the stuff that we share, is our currency of caring. You know, our bathroom. I have a cup. It's on my side because because we had four cups, but three of them are broken, and I have one left. That was given to us from dear friends at our wedding, 1982. And every time I use that cup, hi Roger, hi Francis. Hope you're doing well. Can you think of something in your house or that somebody's given to you that you think of them whenever you use it? Isn't that amazing? I mean, besides just the fact that you might like it, that feeling of connection is right there between people just through our generosity. And it's something to consider when we're generous, either with our resources or with our time or with our presence, it really stays. We feel more connected, and that other person on the receiving end feels more connected. So, this is the first perfection that the Buddha spoke of in the ten. There are ten perfections, and the first one is generosity. Even before the Buddha talked about morality or wisdom or effort or meditation, he said, here, this is something that anyone can experience. We all know the power, the sweetness of sharing. And the karmic result of generosity is abundance. Because when somebody is generous with you, don't you want to be generous back? It's just how it works. When somebody is a little bit not so generous or tight, it doesn't evoke generosity in you. But you can't be generous in order to get things back. That's not how it works. It's just that natural, spontaneous outflow that just comes right from your heart and that touches people. Mm. So this is the first one. Non-greed. In every moment that you're mindful and it's a pleasant moment and you can experience it fully without the grasping, you are practicing non-greed and you're planting very powerful seeds of happiness and well-being. Second, non-hatred or non-aversion, or more positively put, kindness or loving kindness. It's so powerful, and it's amazing again how we're wired up. It didn't have to be this way. Sometimes I think about it, you know, we could just be kind of ants crawling around in our hill with our job to do. I don't know if ants fall in love or they have that sweet connection, but people can touch us and we can feel that connection that you're feeling perhaps in moments in the loving kindness. Aversion or hatred is one of the poisons, and when we're stuck in anger or bitterness, we're the ones that suffer. The Buddha has this image, really powerful image. He says when we're lost in anger, it's like taking a hot coal, wanting to throw it at somebody and hurt them, and not realize we're the ones getting burned in the throwing. Or another image is, it's like taking poison, drinking poison, and hoping the other person is going to get sick. We're the ones that are poisoning ourselves with hatred. And there's so much hatred in this world, isn't there? It's such a painful thing to see how the mind can be caught up through fear, through humiliation, through things happening to us, and hatred comes back. And hatred just begets more hatred. There's a famous teaching from the Buddha. He says, hatred never ceases by hatred. Hatred only ceases by love. This is an ancient and eternal law. So in the moment that we are mindful, that we're present for the unpleasant, and we don't contract in hatred or aversion, we're learning to open up our hearts even to the difficult. And there are a number of different levels of non-hatred or love, loving-kindness, that I want to point out. And then we've been going through the metta practice, and you've seen how the heart can be open so many different ways. First is this kindness, loving-kindness for ourselves. And I hope yesterday when we did that little practice at the end and you maybe got a glimpse of who your friend sees when they're with you, maybe you can see, oh, I'm worthy of kindness. I'm worthy of being treated well. This is central to true happiness. Not that if you don't feel it, you can't feel happy or feel loving, but the more you really get who you are, the more love you have to give. Because you're not busy hoping that everybody is going to validate you and say, yes, you really are okay. When we have that hole inside, then we're mainly our main preoccupation, which about 98% of the population of the world has, is, am I good enough? Am I okay? And we are looking for signs fairly consistently. Oh, I am okay. I hope I'm okay. But when you actually get that you're okay, then you don't have to be wondering, and then you have that much more love to give. When I didn't mention this yesterday, when I did that loving kindness for myself, and I saw myself through someone else's eyes, it wasn't like I was some incredible, mind-blowing human being. It was just, you know, you're really okay. That was it. You know, you're really a decent guy. Oh, I'm really okay? Oh, what a relief. Huh. And then I could start tuning in and just seeing all the goodness around me in a whole other level. There's a beautiful teaching from Zen master Dogen, who lived around the 12th century. He says, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be intimate with all things. So what does that mean? To study Buddhism is to study the self. To practice like you're practicing here is to look at this mind body, this laboratory, to understand what it means to be alive, to be human. To study the self is to forget the self, to forget that small self. Oh, am I good enough? You see, oh, I'm okay. To study the self is to forget this small self. Ah, it's okay. And to forget the self is to be intimate with all things. Then we're all connected. And there's this, the barriers get lifted. So there's loving ourselves, or at least starting to be kind to ourselves. Then there's the interpersonal love. And to see and honor how beautiful it is, the connection that we feel between us and others. And I mentioned it in one of the groups today about the near enemies. Did I mention near enemies here in the bigger room? So each of the these divine abodes, the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, they each are wholesome, sublime states, and they each have what's called a near enemy that looks like the wholesome state, but is very different. So the near enemy of loving kindness, or metta, is attachment. It looks like love, but it's painful. And true love is not painful. Although we talk about the pain of love, and every romance novel, movie, play, every kind of literature and theater about relationships, maybe not every, but most, talk about the pain of love. But it's really talking about attachment. But true love is not painful. And I'll just offer you a little exercise to show you the difference between these. try this out. Just close your eyes for a moment. Here's another little exercise. And bring to mind somebody who, yeah, as Jane said in her her meditation, who makes you smile, or that you feel that sweet connection with, or somebody who's important to you, who is really important to you. That, let that be the category. Somebody who you love and who's really important. Now, first, see them looking back at you, maybe happy that you picked them, and just feel how it is to simply delight in seeing them happy. May you really be happy and know that I so love you. I wish you well and wish you true happiness in this life. And now notice how that feels in your mind and in your body and in your heart. And now think of times when you want something from them, when you don't want them to disappoint you, where you hope that they don't blow it and they come through. When you have an agenda for them, now notice how that feels inside, in your body, in your mind, in your heart. I won't leave you here, don't worry. Take a nice deep breath. And once again, see them smiling and get back in touch with how you really do want to see them happy. And see them smiling. And just let them know how much you really do delight in their well-being and you want the best for them. May you really be happy and peaceful. And just know that I really love you, just for who you are. You can open your eyes if you'd like. Notice any difference? Isn't it amazing how the same person can be a source of just so much happiness and so much pain and sorrow, all within ourselves, just from our expectations or maybe mistrust or maybe insecurity or whatever. Now, of course, we want people to come through for us. We want them to be responsible. But the more you want from someone, or you can think of it the other way. When somebody wants something from you, how do you feel?
Give me a little space.
When they don't want anything other than your well-being, I just want you to be happy. You want to enter into that space, isn't that so? Again, with responsibilities and agreements taken care of, but just how our insecurity keeps us from experiencing the very thing that we long for, that connection. So this is the second one. And it's so beautiful to see that as we are a field of love, then people love being around us. So that's the second level of this non-hatred or loving kindness. A third level that I like to talk about has to do with our own spiritual journey. That is, what brings you here? And particularly for people who do Buddhist practice, it can sometimes be very dry, you know, especially if you've come from traditions like a devotional tradition, you know, from whether it's bhakti Hinduism or certain kinds of Christianity or Judaism or Sufi kinds of practices. Buddhist practice is sometimes called the path with no railings, because the other paths, there's something to lean on, and there's a kind of security there, and there's also, it's so often so heart-oriented. But Buddhist Dharma practice, sometimes people can forget that sadha, that faith, that to put one's heart upon. And so I think it's really important to get in touch with the heart quality. And I'll share with you a story, my own journey, that really showed this to me. Many years ago, when I was first getting into practice, I had been practicing for a couple of years, and the opportunity came to study with Ram Dass, that man who I've mentioned, who wrote Be Here Now, and who said, oh, you just be the best Jamie Barras you can be, that guy. And he is from the devotional, Hindu devotion, bhakti it's called. And there's chanting, and there's mala beads, and there's, you know, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, and all of this. And I had been practicing Buddha Dharma for a few years, and it was a lifesaver. I was so committed to my daily practice, but it was getting a little bit dry. And my teacher, Joseph, said, hey, you might want to check out Ram Dass. He was having this very small scene in New York. This is like in 1975. And it wasn't like an open class. It was by invitation. So by interview. So I had an interview with him to see if it would work for me to be in this class. Well, everybody else is doing Sri Ram, Jai Ram, and I'm kind of been used to just watching my breath. And so we had this exchange. And he said, okay, well, and he was the guy who turned me on to this stuff in the first place. He said, go check out Joseph. But he said, well, okay, this is a devotional scene, so let's see if you could fit in. Let me ask you, how do you feel about Jesus? Do you love Jesus? And I thought for a while, and I said, I like Jesus. He said, no, do you love Jesus? And I said, well, you know, I like Jesus. I love the teaching, so inspiring, but I don't know if I have that same heart quality that I sense you're wondering if I have. I can't say I love Jesus, honestly. But I do like him. He said, okay. How about Krishna? Do you love Krishna? I said, I like Krishna. Just, he represents this celebration and delight and loving of life, and it's inspiring. Do I like Krishna? I don't know if I love Krishna. He said, okay. How about God? Do you love God? And I said, well, you know, Ram Dass, I was raised in the Jewish faith, and my image of God, maybe it was from an early children's Bible book, but my image of God was this very powerful, scary guy with a big beard and a big book and a pen saying, you're going to have a good day and you're going to have a bad day. And it put the fear of God into me, but I don't know about the love of God. So when I hear the word God, I translate it into Dharma, which is, for me, the perfection, the mystery of it all, how it all hangs together, and how it's all amazingly perfect. So when I hear God, I think of Dharma. And he said, oh, okay, well, let me ask you, do you love the Dharma? And that one, I didn't have to hesitate. I said, oh, yeah. He said, you sure? I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. And then he said, well, have you ever told the Dharma that you loved it? I said, no. He said, well, go ahead. I said, what do you mean? He said, go ahead. Tell the Dharma, say, I love you, Dharma. I said, really? He said, I'll say it with you. Go ahead, you say it. I said, okay. And I felt completely stupid. I love you, Dharma. And he said, I love you, Dharma. And I said, I love you, Dharma. And he said, I love you, Dharma. And by the third or fourth time, I just felt it. And tears started streaming down my face. At which point he said, oh, there's hope for you yet. I did end up being in that class for a few years. But it was a really powerful moment for me to realize how much I love this stuff. And it's something that I think everybody here, to some extent, one way or another, whether it's Dharma practice with a capital D, or just you love the truth, or you're drawn to the truth, or you're drawn to goodness, that you love it. That's a very important thing to see. That's where it's more than just this dry practice, oh yes, you know, breathing in, breathing out, big deal, you know, sound. You love the truth. Why else would you do it? But we often don't realize how connected we are in deep inside. Something has called you very deeply that you can't ignore, even though you perhaps at times wish you could ignore it. Who needs this? Why don't I just go to the beach for my weekend and my week? But it's called you and you can't ignore it. There's no turning back. The other choice is cultivating more greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's too late. So that's another level of love. Loving the truth, loving the Dharma. And there's even a deeper level which leads to the third of these, which is the love that comes from emptiness, the love that comes when you see through that sense of separation. Because even loving the Dharma is me loving the Dharma. But when that me and the Dharma collapses and it's just life loving itself, that's the deepest kind of heart opening. And so that leads to non-delusion. Non-delusion. I spoke a little bit about this when I gave the talk on the five faculties of faith and effort, mindfulness, concentration, leading to wisdom. Non-delusion is another way of saying wisdom. And what is wisdom? There's a few ways to think of this wisdom. One is seeing through some distortions of perception, what in the teachings are called vipalasas, distortions of perception, and that is taking what is impermanent to be permanent, taking what is suffering to be a cause of happiness, and taking what is selfless to be self. Those are the three characteristics that things are impermanent, there is suffering in trying to hold on to what is impermanent, and we ourselves are this impermanent flux of reality. But when we get confused, we take what is impermanent to be permanent. Oh, if I only get this, then I'll really be happy. That'll do it for me. Gone. Oh, if I really hold on, then I'll get it together, keep it together. Suffering. Oh, I'm me, and you better watch out. I am this selfless unfolding of experience. So those are the deepest levels of wisdom. But in every moment that you see your experience and don't identify with it, like, oh, look at that amazing thought that came through my mind, that bizarre one of blowing up the world, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, interesting, okay. Oh, look at this pain in my heart that I take to be me, when it's just a visitor that's come and is here for a while and that goes, and it doesn't have to be me, and there's an awareness that can see it. Ah, there's freedom. You're not who you think you are. And I'll read a lovely passage. This is from a book by a biologist many years ago, a famous, very wise man named Lewis Thomas. And he wrote this book called Lives of a Cell and describing who you really are. Check this out. He says, a good case can be made for our non-existence as solid entities. We're not made up, as we had always supposed, of successively enriched packets of our own parts. We are shared, rented, occupied. At the interior of our own cells, driving them, providing the energy that sends us out for the improvement of each shining day, are mitochondria. And in a strict sense, they're not ours. They turn out to be little separate creatures, replicating in their own fashion, privately, with their own DNA and RNA, quite different from ours. Without them, we would not move a muscle, drum a finger, think a thought. Mitochondria are stable and responsible lodgers, and I choose to trust them. But there are also other little animals similarly established in my cells, sorting out and balancing me, clustering me together. My centrioles, basal bodies, and probably a good many other more obscure tiny beings at work inside my cells, each with its own special genome, and they are as foreign and as essential as aphids in anthills. My cells are not the pure line entities I was raised with. They are ecosystems more complex than the Jamaican Bay outside my door. I like to think that they work in my interest, that each breath they draw for me. But perhaps it is they who walk the local park in the early morning, sensing my senses, listening to my music, thinking my thoughts. You're an ecosystem. check that out. As one of my, as Wes Nisker, my friend, he wrote this book, Buddha's Nature, he says, right now, in your mouth, there are more living organisms than there have been humans since the beginning of time. It's true. And in your stomach, way more. So who do you think you are, anyway? You are an ecosystem, and there's a pattern that's specifically Krista or Rita or Sally or James, and it holds together, thank goodness, but it's not as solid as you think. So this is a deep understanding of the selfless nature of who you are. And this is non-delusion. This is seeing you are a field of activity. You are life happening and expressing itself through this form. And every time you are mindful and you see, oh, that thought isn't me. It comes out of nowhere, goes to nowhere. Oh, this sensation isn't me. It's part of this flowing system. Oh, this emotion isn't me. It doesn't mean that I'm a pathetic loser. It's just this feeling that's come. It comes and it goes. And nowhere in there can you say, oh, that's who I am. How freeing that is. So every time that you're mindful and don't take ownership and identify with your thoughts, there's freedom. So this is how we transform suffering into happiness. In every moment that you're mindful, instead of cultivating grasping, aversion, delusion, greed, hatred, delusion, you're cultivating non-grasping, letting go, a generous heart, non-hatred, or kindness, friendliness, non-delusion, clarity, wisdom. Every single moment counts. And you've been putting in a lot of moments these days. How wonderful. Okay, so let's see for a moment. Thank you.